Our first guest is Candace Plator. Candace graduated from the Adler School of Professional Psychology with a master's degree in counseling psychology in 2001. For over 20 years in her private practice, she's been helping clients and their loved ones understand their addictive behaviors and make healthier life choices. Her award-winning books, Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, The Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction, and Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, The Workbook, are available in bookstores throughout Canada and the U.S. and online at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. Please visit her website, which is Candace, C-A-N-D-A-C-E, Plator, Plator.com, where you can get more information about Candace, her work, and her books. Welcome, Candace. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello.
Hello, Candace.
Hello, Sherry.
Hi.
So, Candace, we like to start our show each week, as Sherry knows, by asking our guests to talk about a significant moment of change in their life. Something transformational, one of those aha moments. And I'm sure you've had many. We've all had many. But is there one that comes to mind that you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, there is. I've been clean and sober from mind-altering substances and many other kinds of addictive behaviors for almost 26 years now. And 26 years ago, this coming month, in June, I reached the bottom for myself, and I was so depressed that I actually became suicidal and made a decision that I was going to get some help from there. I voluntarily signed myself into a psych ward, and I was there for about 3 weeks just trying to stay safe and learn about who I am and start a program of recovery, which I started to do while I was there. And, every year around this time, I like to celebrate the fact that I'm still here and that I'm not just still alive, but that I'm living and thriving. And so, for anybody else who may be feeling this way, who's listening right now, please know that there is hope and there is help, and just please reach out. Just keep going.
Wow, that's really inspiring, Candace. Is that what made you decide to work in the addictions field, or was it a combination of things that brought you to that decision and that as your life, path?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was already a counselor working with youth, and I had been a teacher before that in the public school system for many years. So I was already a counselor when I had my breakdown. And the more I learned about addiction, because I knew nothing, I was addicted for many, many years. My addiction started with prescription drugs for my Crohn's disease, which I was diagnosed with in 1973. So I had many years of using a lot of medications and didn't realize what they were doing to me. But the more I learned about addiction, the more I wanted to give back in that way. And, I received so much help from people. That's why I'm still here, because I received so much help. And I wanted to be one of those people that could help others. And as time went on, I was working with addicts and alcoholics in the downtown East Side area of Vancouver. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's the lowest income postal code in Canada, basically. So I was there for 16 years. And during that time, I also started working with the loved ones of the clients that I had, so that became a specialty of mine as well. But I think to answer your question, my own understanding of addiction from a personal and professional standpoint, I think the combination of those two really makes this what I'm supposed to be doing.
Thank you, Candace. Welcome. This is Sherry.
Hi, Sherry.
You know, I have to say one thing that I have learned, you know, for a lot of the individuals that I work with in the treatment field, I find that a lot of them give up their own, you know, 12-step program or their recovery program when they get in the field, and I think that's a huge mistake. They end up thinking that just because they work in the field that somehow they still have a recovery program. Would you agree?
I agree with what you're saying. I think it's really important to work a recovery program, absolutely, on some level. The 12 steps are fantastic for the people that it works for, and it doesn't work for everybody. So
right.
There are some alternatives now to that, and I think people need to be doing something and need to be to make sure that they're taking care of themselves in that kind of way and that they're accountable to people. And, you know, one of my biggest bugaboos, I guess, is when people in this profession don't take care of themselves and don't work their own program, because I think they can become dangerous to the clients they're working with. And so I think it's really important for us to be walking the same walk. You know, walking our talk with our clients and making sure that we're doing that.
And I think especially for us as healers, you know, I had to deal with addiction in my own family. You know, of course, I'm in recovery myself, but I think as healers, we become especially over the top in caregiving. And if we're not careful, that becomes our higher power, the higher power of that other person becomes our God, and then
mm-hmm.
we forget about
mm-hmm.
ourselves. And I hope that you'll speak to that today, because I think people really lose themselves when someone they love is in the midst of their own disease.
Mm-hmm. And I will definitely speak to that. You know, and I don't need to go into it a lot right now, but just to comment on what you're saying, I see codependency as an addictive behavior. And codependency is a buzzword that's bandied around a lot. Not everybody knows what it means. And my really simple definition of codependency is when people put other people's needs ahead of their own on a fairly consistent basis.
Well,
and that becomes an addictive behavior for a lot of people.
So what would you say would be the difference then between helping someone and actually enabling somebody?
Ah, I love talking about that. You know, with a helping behavior, helping behaviors are healthy behaviors that help that lead an addiction to stop. But an enabling behavior is something that keeps the addictive behavior going. And you know, the example that I can use with a helping behavior, you're setting a boundary. You're setting a clear, healthy boundary, saying maybe something like, you know, I love you, but I'm not happy with your behavior. And until you're really ready to get some help, you know, when you are ready to get some help, you let me know. But until you are, I really don't want to be here. So when you are ready to get help, I'm here for you 100%, not 101%, but 100%. If you'll work as hard as I will with you, I'm here for you, but I will no longer work harder than you. That would be a helping behavior, a healthy boundary. An unhealthy, enabling behavior, I see this kind of thing a lot, is where, you know, loved ones, they love their addicted people so very, very much, and they're so afraid of what's going to happen to them or what could happen to them. They'll do things like drive an addict to a dealer to get the drugs, because at least they know where their addict is. They're sitting in the car beside them. Not only that, sometimes they'll pay for the drugs. They'll pay an addict's rent so that the person can actually go and use that money on something else. Those are enabling behaviors. The thing that loved ones need to do is assist, I'd like to say help, but assist an addict to start feeling uncomfortable in their lives and for there to be consequences for their behaviors, so that they get to a place where they think to themselves, oh, you know, I'm not really enjoying this anymore. This isn't really what I want. I don't like this life. Unless there are consequences for somebody with an addiction, why should they stop? If people are enabling them and rescuing them, why should they do anything different?
Candace, this is Kathleen.
We have to
take our first break, but I'd like to continue on this question after the break, and in particular of how do people know when it's time, for example, that someone has to be out of the house, you know, where it's causing so much disruption. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that when we come back from the break.
Sure.
Okay, this is a moment of change. We're going to break, and we'll be back with Candace Plator.
Are you feeling exasperated and helpless concerning your family member's addiction? Are you at your wit's end, having tried everything you can think of to make them stop? Registered clinical counselor Candace Plator has written two books to help you get off the roller coaster chaos of addiction, maintain your own sanity, and live your best life. Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the top 10 tips for loving someone with an addiction, and Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, the workbook, are available at Amazon and in a bookstore near you.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to A Moment of Change. I'm Kathleen, here with Sherry, and we've been talking with psychologist Candace Plator about addiction and the differences between helping and enabling. And just before the break, Candace, I had asked you, how does one know when things are at the point where really the addict has to get out of the house because it is such disruption, let's say, to the other children or the family?
Right.
And how do we get to that point, or how does someone get to that point to make that decision? And when is that the right decision?
What a great question. And, you know, I was listening to the advertisements during the break, and I really like the idea of the fact that there isn't a cookie-cutter approach to this. You know, I can answer to the best of my ability, but it's not going to be the same for every family. But what I can say is that in my experience, most people know when that time is, most loved ones know when that time is, way before they act on it. And that can be problematic. I think what happens with a lot of loved ones, again, they're scared of what can happen. They're scared of saying to their addicted loved one, you have to leave, because what might happen to them on the street? Oh no, they'll be on the street. They won't have any place to go. And what happens is that, you know, sometimes that's exactly what needs to occur. Sometimes the addict needs to be on the street for a few nights and see that life is not very good out there in order for them to want to make a change and in order for them to start respecting what they've had at home, because often addicts treat their families especially very disrespectfully. You know, they get very angry, they say things, they yell, they scream, they steal, they manipulate, you know, and they just treat people very disrespectfully. When they are asked to leave the home, or sometimes forced to leave the home, that gives them a whole different perspective on what it is that their addiction is causing them to give up.
Yes.
And they can get to a place of making a different choice. One of the things that the way I work, which is different from maybe the way other people work with addiction, I don't necessarily see addiction as a physical disease. I mean, I know that there's body involvement and that there's brain involvement, but for me, I have a medical disease. I have Crohn's disease, and I can't just say to myself, gee, I think I won't have Crohn's anymore. I can take better care of myself and maybe not be as sick, which is what I do in my life, but But somebody with cancer, for example, can't just say, gee, I think I won't have cancer or diabetes or something like that. So to me, you know, it doesn't fit into that exact category, because with addiction, you can stop the behavior and arrest the addiction. It's a choice.
Yes,
it may be, you know, it has physical a physical component. It could have a genetic predisposition depending on what the addiction is. It could be a learned behavior that you learned in your childhood. But underneath all of that, addiction is a choice. You're either going to do it or you're not going to do it.
I think what you're talking about is you have the choice to pick up that drink or that drug, and once you do that, then it is no longer a choice. I mean, I think
yes.
That's what you're trying
yes.
to say. I mean, when you know, for the loved one, I mean, I think it's all about, I mean, this was just a wonderful thing I learned. I ran a family program at a famous rehab in Malibu. I still work in Malibu, but it's all about, and it really is just, it sounds simple. I mean, it's not as simple as it sounds. You know, you're going to support the recovery. You're not going to enable the disease. So what does that mean? You're going to support getting them help, but you're not going to enable them. And if enabling
yes.
them, you know, means having them not live at home because living at home is too easy for them and they're continuing
that's right.
their destructive behavior, then you're not going to enable them. And then you
yes.
have the compassion. And you know, yes, you understand, you know, it's not my child. I wouldn't want my child to be out in the streets. But you know what? You may be hurting them more by them living in the home. You know, you
mm-hmm.
may be hurting them more.
I absolutely agree with you, Sherry. I totally agree. And that's exactly how I work. You know, when people enable, and sometimes I say this to my clients who are loved ones, and it's hard for them to hear, but I think they need to kind of get their heads around it, that sometimes when people are enabling, it feels like they're loving their addicted loved one, but it really isn't love.
Right.
And sometimes it's about fulfilling their own needs, which can be a little bit selfish. They want to make sure that the addict is okay. I get that entirely. I have been there. I get that. But that's not necessarily helpful or loving toward the addict. That isn't necessarily going to get the addict into a place of thinking, I need to stop this. I'm losing too much. I don't like what's happening to me. And that's the ultimate goal.
It's so true. I mean, when I was in the thick of this, and I mean, I know this so well professionally and personally, but I just didn't want this person to die. I mean, that was all I could think about. And I think that's how families feel. They just
yes.
think that somehow that, and you know, and then again, I hate to be cliche, but then we realize we are not their higher power. They have their own higher power.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own higher power. We are not it. You know,
right.
we think that we are, and it's a, you know, it's a yeah. very dangerous place to be. So,
yeah.
I mean, what would you say to somebody that's dealing with this right now, someone that's in a relationship or has a child, and they're just stuck, and they don't know what to do? What would you say?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I deal with that a lot, often, in my practice, and what I first say is, yes, I know, I understand how scary this is for you, how painful this has been for you. This is such a difficult experience. So I let them know that I understand that. And I also say to them, most people know, just like I said before, most people know when they need to tell somebody to leave long before they do it, right? But, you know, they know what they need to do. They just don't want to do it.
Right.
And that's understandable that they don't want to do it. It's totally understandable that they don't want to do it. But they know what they need to do. And often when I talk with them about what are the steps that they really need to do to help and not enable, many of them feel so validated because they've been thinking about this themselves, you know, like showing them the door if they've been very abusive.
Right.
They really appreciate the fact that somebody, especially a professional, you know, somebody like myself will say to them, yes, this is the right thing to do. You
right.
are thinking about the right thing to do.
Right. Well,
that
yeah,
doesn't make it less scary. It's going to be scary.
you need the support of others. I mean, that's why I'm a big believer. Again, not everybody, the 12 steps don't work for everyone, but Al-Anon is such an amazing program because sometimes you just don't know what to do and you need to hear from others that have, you know, walked that road and,
that's
you know,
right.
And know what to say, and when you're not thinking clearly, they can think for you in a way, because when you're in the thick of it, you know, you really aren't always making the best decisions. And,
that's
you know,
right.
As we know, with addiction, you know, even the loved ones are in denial. You know, the addict
yes.
alcoholic has denial of their disease, and then the loved one is in denial of the whole situation, right?
Yeah. Well, I consider loved ones in that situation, that loved ones are addicted to the addict's addiction.
Oh, yeah.
And what I mean by that is that when the addicts are doing okay, the loved ones are doing okay. And when the addict isn't doing okay, the loved one isn't doing okay. So that's the roller coaster chaos that I talk about. And the loved ones need to get off that roller coaster. And they need to be showing the addict that, you know, if these are the choices you're going to make, I'm not going to be there with you anymore around that. When you want to get healthy, I'm here.
Candace, this is Kathleen again.
Yes, Kathleen.
There's such confusion right now around marijuana and its use.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, I know that someone can have just as strong an addiction to pot as to anything else. How
yes.
do you define an addiction? Because there's a lot of confusion around that particular drug right
mm-hmm.
now because of the changing laws. And I
yes.
always try to tell my clients is it's not so much the substance, although that's certainly important, but it's really about how the addiction, it's an addiction when it impairs the ability to live a normal life, to have healthy relationships, and brings on a lot of other destructive tendencies. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that most things can be used in moderation unless we have addictive tendencies, and we have to get underneath the addiction to find out why we're using this in that way in the first place. So, I mean, I think there are some people, I don't necessarily understand them myself because I'm an addict in recovery, but there are some people who can smoke pot socially, and it doesn't interfere with their lives. And to me, that's when an addiction, when a behavior becomes an addiction, is when it really starts interfering with a person's life. So what I know to be absolutely true from my own personal experience, because pot was one of my drugs, I totally understand medical marijuana for the use of pain, you know, for relief of pain. That's why I started using it. But it's addictive. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
So we have to be really careful with a drug like that. And I think one of the reasons that people say, oh, it's not addictive, is denial. They don't want to think it is addictive. It's addictive.
Yes.
It's
well,
a
believe
problem.
It or not,
it's a problem drug. And today, it's a very different drug often than what it was when I was using it, because it's cut with things that are much more dangerous. And it's also
yeah.
very, very bad for the lungs and for other organs. And, you know, it's just not a good drug.
Thanks, Candace. I think that's just helps clarify that issue for people. Believe it or not, we're coming to the close of our time with you.
Aww.
I wish we had more time. This is such a fascinating conversation.
Amazing.
Could you please just, we want to make sure our listeners know where to learn more about you, your work, if you have any upcoming event you want to mention, and where to get your book. So just let us know that again.
Okay. Well, my website is Candace. I was going to give you my email address. My website is www.candaceplatter.com, and it's CandacePlattor. In terms of upcoming events, one that might be of interest to people because it's going to be in California, I'm going to be speaking at in San Diego in June at the NASAP convention, which is the annual Adlerian conference that happens in different places all over the world each year. And this year it's happening in San Diego. So I'm going to be speaking about being a loved one. I'm going to be speaking at that conference. So if you're interested, please go to my website and look under the page that tells you about events. If you're interested in my book, there's a product page that will tell you all about my books. And if you're thinking that you would like to read my book, then you probably need to read it. So, again, it's one of those things where you've known this for a while. Now it's time to really admit it to yourself and get the help you need as a loved one so that you can actually help instead of enable your addict to stop doing what they're doing.
Thank you, Candace.
Thank you so much, Candace. And by the way, you know, on your website, I hope you list all of your workshops and whatnot and speaking engagements, because we are all over the Internet, and we're also in Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Pittsburgh. So
wonderful. Yeah.
So just,
I will make sure that that's happening. I believe it is, but I will make sure that that's happening. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you are so welcome.